That brings us to our speaker. Tonight we have Jessica from Absecon Speakers Group in Absecon, New Jersey.
Hello everyone, my name is Jessica and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank the group for having me out tonight. It is always an honor to be able to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come out and I accept invitations like this because it was told to me very early on in sobriety that we have a duty in this program to go out and share a message of hope and recovery, and that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. So I will tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. First, I have a sobriety date. It is August 21st of 2011. I have a sponsor. I have been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they are outlined in the book. I have a home group, and I have the absolute honor of and privilege of sponsoring other women in the program. So I'll start at the beginning. I had my first drink when I was 13 years old. My first drink was actually in Disney World with my parents. I like to tell this story because I haven't heard anybody else in the rooms that have gotten to say that their first drink was in Disney World. So we went on this family vacation, and I was not thrilled about it. I was 13 years old, and I thought it was way too cool to be going to Disney World with my parents and my little sister. So I spent the majority of the time whining, because I did very well, and complaining that I had to be there and that it was hot and my parents were annoying and my sister didn't stop crying, and I just really didn't have anything all that pleasant to say for the majority of the time that we were there. But then one day I was out with my parents, and my parents like to drink the way I do, so they can find a bar pretty much any place they are. So we were at this bar, this little tiki bar someplace, and my mother ordered this pretty pink, fruity-looking drink with a nice little umbrella in it, and I asked her if I could have a sip. So I took a sip, and it tasted a little strange. So I tried another sip, and that was much better. And by the next sip, I knew there was no way that my mother was getting that drink back. By the bottom of that drink, I was no longer miserable and unhappy to be in Disney World. I was thrilled. It was the most beautiful, magical place on earth. My parents were wonderful. My little sister was adorable. And I was ready to go and hang out with Mickey Mouse. Yeah, that's what alcohol does for me. It makes situations that I find unbearable, bearable. So naturally, when we got home from this trip, I chased that feeling. And, you know, I found the people that were drinking and partying on the weekends, and I hooked right up with them. And I would go and do what they were doing, and you know, we'd party on the weekends, and by the time Monday hit, you know, we got out of school on Monday, and I was already planning for the next weekend. You know, I wanted to know by Tuesday and have it confirmed how, when, and where the liquor was coming from. You know, I'm collecting money and making sure that everything is set in stone, so come Friday, everything goes down with absolutely no problem. Because I needed to drink. I found in high school, pretty early on in my drinking, I drank pretty much the same in the beginning as I did in the end, and that was that I like to get as much in me as quickly as possible to get me to where I needed to be. That was usually passed out or blacked out and causing some sort of commotion. So, pretty early. People didn't really enjoy drinking with me. They didn't like to have to explain to their parents, you know, why their things were broken or the cops were being called to the house or who the naked girl was running through their living room. And so people tried to avoid me and my drinking. And I found a really good way to fix that. If you buy the alcohol, people are a little more willing to have you come around. So what I started doing was stealing from my job to get an extra few $100s in my pocket and, you know, come Friday and make sure that I treated for all the alcohol, and that way I was welcome wherever the party was. When I got out of high school, I went off to college. I moved into my own apartment, and my drinking really took off. I started drinking just about every day, and that was because, you know, in high school during the week, it was a little difficult to get liquor every single day, so I was using other substances to get me through the week until the weekend arrived. But when I started college, I decided that, you know, it was time to grow up and get serious, and I really needed to do well in school. So I was going to stop all those other substances, and I was just going to drink. So that's what I did every day. And it didn't matter if my class got out at 8 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock in the morning. I was going straight from class to the liquor store, sitting outside waiting for some poor sucker to take my money and go in and get me a bottle of whatever it was that I wanted. And I'd go back to my apartment and I'd drink by myself. And I wasn't much of a social drinker. Again, it kind of looked like, it, you know, if you drank with me once, that was probably enough. Usually went one of two ways. You drank with me, and then you didn't really want to talk to me again, or you drank with me and you wanted to talk to me about my drinking, and then I didn't want to talk to you anymore. So, yeah, the social drinking is kind of out. Consequences, you know, start to roll in pretty quickly. I got my first DUI when I was 21. And I get this DUI and I'm pissed off. You know, I'm really angry. I'm angry at the police and my car, the road. I mean, anything that I possibly be mad at so that I don't have to take any responsibility for this myself. But anyway, so I get this DUI and they send me to these IDCR, the Intoxicated Driving Resource classes. And I get there and I'm sitting in the room and there is a room full of people and we get to go around and share a little bit about how we got there. So I realized as we were going around this room, people were sharing their stories, that a lot of them had been there before. And they had multiple DUIs. Some people were losing their license for 2 years, 10 years. Some were facing jail time. And all I could think as these people are sharing is, what morons? Because how could you possibly make this mistake more than once? I find it a lot easier to look at what other people are doing or not doing rather than taking a look at myself, because that would just be too painful. However, I did say that was my first DUI, so I came to learn how you can make that mistake more than once. So I get a lawyer, and I tell the lawyer, I don't care what you got to do. Whatever you got to do, just get me out of this. I can't lose my license for 6 months. I'm 21 years old. That would just be the end of the world. So he's like, okay, let me see what I can do. He calls me back a few days later, and I can tell but tone of his voice, he just seems agitated. And he tells me that there's no way he's going to get me out of this. And I asked him why, and he said it's really difficult to fight a case and try to tell him that you aren't drinking because I had refused the breathalyzer. Really drumming bad. So it's hard to tell them that you aren't drinking when you have like 10 empty vodka bottles in your back seat. It's like, yeah, I hadn't cleaned out my car that week. So, yeah, so I lost my license for 7 months since I said for the refusal of breathalyzer. So that was probably one of my many first major consequences. My mother used to tell me that, like, when I drank, after a couple of drinks, there was this switch that went off. And her sweet, lovable daughter all of a sudden turned into this, like, mean, violent, angry person. And, you know, she's my mom, so I wasn't really buying it. I thought she was kind of, like, out to get me. However, I started seeing little things happen that made it kind of clear that she might have a point. For one thing, I woke up one morning in this apartment that I was living at with a boyfriend, and I went into the living room and he was sleeping on the couch, and he wakes up and rolls over, and I asked him, "Honey, why didn't you come to bed last night?" And I see that he's got this like big black eye and this huge bloody scratch across his face. And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" And it's like, "You!" apparently he had said something the night before that I disagreed with. Wish I could say that was the only time something like that happened, but it definitely wasn't. Another time I was at a bar with another poor boyfriend. And we left this bar and it was about, 2 o'clock. And I wasn't done. I wasn't blacked out or passed out, so I wasn't where I wanted to be. So I wanted to find a way to get more alcohol, and he was done, he was ready to go home, and he didn't want to hear it, so I did the only logical thing that I could think of, and I grabbed his steering wheel and tried to steer towards, I don't know, wherever I thought alcohol was. He said something about me being crazy and trying to kill us. So he kicked me out of the car, and I was walking down this dark back road in a really sketchy town in New Jersey at, after 2 o'clock in the morning at this point. Dressed probably not very appropriately. And I'm walking down the road, and luckily I was stopped by the cops. And I say luckily because, like I said, it was not a very nice area to be in. And these cops stopped me, and they asked me what I'm doing. So of course I went into my poor me, and I'm crying about my horrible boyfriend that kicked me out of the car and left me on the side of the road, and giving them this whole sob story. So they seem like they're feeling bad for me, and that was kind of the end of it. Next thing I knew, I woke up in the psych ward at the local the hospital. That was my first trip to a psych ward. And I had no idea how I got there. The nurses were able to fill me in that the cops had dropped me off at the hospital, and I was saying something about suicide, so they brought me over to the psych ward, and that's what I was doing there. So I sobered up enough, and they decided that I was not suicidal, and they would let me call for a ride home. So I called my aunt, and she hung up on me. No idea why. So I called her back, and she picks up, and she's screaming and yelling. And finally, she tells me what had happened the night before. Apparently, the cops had given me a phone to call somebody to come pick me up from where I was, and I called my aunt, and my uncle came out at 2:30 or whatever it was in the morning from, over a half hour away to come and pick me up, and when he got there, I punched him in the face. No idea why. So he was just said he was not coming to pick me up in the psych ward. very nice person when I'm drinking. I got this job in the city. It was this really great job, and I loved it. And I was living about 2 hours away, so I had to be on the bus by 6 a.m. to make it into work to get to this job. And, it was getting, after a very short period of time, it was getting really difficult to make it back and forth. I was, I was shaking all the time, and I was having withdrawals trying to sit at my desk. So what I started doing was I was waking up at about 4 a.m. just to start taking shots to get out of bed and get into the shower and hope that by the time I got onto the bus at 6, that would be good enough to get me through the day and get home. That didn't last long, and eventually I started drinking on the bus on the way into work, and then, at lunch and on the way home, and, eventually the job just was getting in the way of my drinking altogether. So I ended up losing that job, and I put myself up into this, motel by the shore in New Jersey in the middle of the winter. It was November when I was there. Thanksgiving rolled around when I was staying at this motel by myself in this gloomy shore town in the middle of the winter, and my mother had come to pick me up for Thanksgiving dinner that we were going to at my grandmother's house. I don't know exactly what my mom said or did when she got there, but again, I ended up in some physical altercation with her, and my little sister pulled the cops on me, and that's the way I spent Thanksgiving in jail. I got released later that night once they thought that I was safe to leave, and I don't know, you'd think maybe I'd call a family member or a friend. Well, I didn't really have any friends left, but somebody to come and pick me up. But I called a cab to take me to the liquor store before I went back to the motel and continued to drink by myself. That's all I knew how to do. Something bad happened, my answer was to drink. I couldn't deal with the emotions and the feelings that came along with anything, really, good or bad. Being sober for me is just so incredibly painful, that's unbearable. So when I was staying at this motel, my drinking got to a point that was, I was quite sure I was going to die. I was physically dependent on alcohol, I had stopped eating, I couldn't keep anything down, and my body was just deteriorating, and I was certain I was going to die. So somehow, I managed to get myself to a place where I was decreased my drinking enough to be able to pick up the phone and call a family member to come get me out of this motel. They did, and it was my aunt and poor uncle that I punched in the face, and I went and I stayed with them for a few weeks. And the importance of the story is that I was so certain that I was going to die in that motel room. I was positive, and I swore that, I prayed that if I could just get through this, there was no way I would ever pick up a drink again. Absolutely not. I was at my aunt and uncle's for a couple of weeks, and what usually happened. I started to eat again, stopped shaking so much, started thinking a little clearer, and as soon as I started feeling a little bit better, all that other stuff started to kick in. The reality of life and having to deal with life kicked in, and I had to pick up a drink. Shortly after that, I got my second DUI. And again, my lawyer was not happy about this DUI, because I don't know, I guess I'd really like to make these guys work for their money. But he calls me up, you know, kind of angry, and tells me that that I'm probably not going to get out of this DUI. And I'm lucky that I'm not getting charges for, like, resisting arrest or anything else like that, because I thought it would be cute, because when I got this DUI, like, six cop cars showed up. It was, I just felt like everything was being, like, blown way out of proportion. So I'm telling the cops, like, look at me, this is totally unnecessary. I'm, like, 110 pounds, and you guys all are here, and, it, you know, whatever. So they handcuffed me, and they put me in the back of the car, and that just sent me, like, right over the edge. So I thought I was being cute, and I slipped my hand out of the handcuffs and showed them that they have nothing to worry about. The cops didn't find that cute. So that was my second DUI. With another refusal, of course, because I know better. And I lost my license for 2 years on that one. Plenty of fines and consequences there. So there's definitely some consequences through my drinking, and there was periods of time where I felt like maybe I should do something, maybe I should stop drinking, maybe, and I try, and like I said, I get to that point where, you know, life set in, and it was just too much to bear, and I had to pick up a drink again. But this time, when I decided to get sober, there wasn't much going on. You know, there was no arrests, I didn't get any DUIs, I didn't tick anybody off. Actually, I did. What had happened was I was living with yet another poor boyfriend, and we had a wedding to go to. And this guy had already been on me about my drinking. He had seen that there was definitely a problem and was giving me a hard time. So I assured him that at the wedding, I wouldn't do anything to embarrass him. I know this was important to him. I promised I would keep it under control, and I really meant it. However, I know now that I have absolutely no control over my drinking. And, you know, I picked up the first one, and all bets were off. And I ended up attacking this guy on the middle of the dance floor and, like, beating him up or something. So the next day when I went to go home, he had changed the locks on me, which I thought was just a little ridiculous. Guy couldn't even take one beating. So I went to stay at my mother's house, which really isn't all that bad of a deal, because my mother drinks like I do. So as long as, like, you know, I can drink and she can drink and we can stay out of our way, each other's way enough to, you know, not end up in, like, some kind of physical battle, it's not too bad. So I was there for a few days, and I woke up one morning, and it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and I went downstairs, and my mother was sitting in the kitchen, and she turned to me and said some, like, really nice motherly type of thing, like, you know, this will always be your home, you're welcome here anytime, I love you. But she was slurring her words and stumbling and practically falling down when she said it. And it dawned on me that it was, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning. And here she is at 50 years old, you know, sitting in her kitchen completely alone with absolutely nothing going on in her life, totally and completely miserable. And whether it was a moment of clarity, whatever it was, I saw my future, if I was lucky enough to get to that point, because the way I was drinking, I'm pretty sure I would not have. So I decided that day that I was done. I was done drinking, and I really meant it this time, and I picked up the phone. And I called my sister, because my sister's boyfriend, I knew, was in AA, and I had known him for a long time, a number of years. I knew him when he was drinking, and he had been known him for a little while in sobriety. And I was able to see that he seemed to be enjoying what he was doing. So I called her and I asked if he would take me to a meeting, and they came and picked me up, and he brought me to a meeting that night. And I went in, and you know, I hear people talk about, like, they walk through the doors and, you know, they had arrived and they felt that, like, they were at home in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that wasn't my experience. I was not happy to be there. I was extremely uncomfortable. I was sad and angry, and I was just a mess. And you know, I walked out of that meeting and thanked him and said, "I'm never doing that again." Luckily, he was a good member of the program, and he dragged my butt back the next night. And that was my not so graceful entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in the rooms for about a week, and I was in this meeting, and a girl got up and she spoke. And what I heard this girl share about was, you know, it wasn't, we didn't drink at the same places, we didn't drink the same type of stuff. You know, there was definitely a lot of differences in our stories, but what I really heard from her story was that how she felt when she was sober, you know, and that I was able to relate to, that discomfort, the disconnect, and just wanted to, like, crawl out of my skin and get my hair out, and I was either going to pick up a drink or kill myself. And she said that, and I heard it, so I got up, and I asked this girl if she would be my sponsor. I actually asked her to be my temporary sponsor because I had heard that someplace in the rooms. And she turned to me and asked me if I wanted temporary sobriety. Yeah. I probably should have just turned and ran at that point, but I know any better. But thank God I didn't, because this girl was great. She lived over an hour away from me, and she would come every day and pick me up and drop me off every night. And I mean, just to give you a little idea about, like, my ego, I was thinking that, like, she was lonely, but she really liked me and she just needed a friend and wanted me to be her friend. Obviously, I came to learn that that's not the case. She took me everywhere that she went, and I got to watch what she was doing and the other members of our home group were doing, and she started taking me through the steps right away. And I believe that that was the difference. That was the change from all those other times that I had tried to stay sober and failed miserably, ending up suicidal or picking up a drink. So I started going through these steps with this girl. And we went through my first two steps, and I did my third step with my entire home group and the church, all down on our knees. We said the prayer and got up, and everybody hugged me, which was a little strange to me. And but it felt nice, and I felt like, you know, something might be going to work there. But I called that guy that had taken me to my first two meetings, and I called him and I told him that, like, I went through my first three steps, I'm going to be starting my fourth, and, you know, I started writing, and he was like, whoa. He sounded really concerned, and he told me, like, I don't know about this, that's not exactly, you may not want to do it that way, you're supposed to take your time. So again, here comes my ego, and I'm thinking, like, oh, well, I entered the accelerated program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This girl obviously saw how smart I am and started taking the steps away. I made the mistake of sharing that story at a podium that my sponsor was speaking with me after, and she quickly got up and told the crowd that I absolutely did not enter any accelerated program at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was nowhere as smart as I thought I was. And just said she saw that I was really sick, and if I didn't take some serious action quickly, I was probably going to die. And that was the truth. I couldn't continue to live the way that I was living. And I'm really grateful that she saw that. So around this time, my sponsor asked me to make a list of my character defects, and I made the list, and I showed it to her, and she looked at the paper, and she laughed hysterically at the five words that I had written on the paper. And all I could think was, like, man, what a bitch. Luckily, you know, she cared enough, and she had enough experience that she knew that telling me the truth and not worrying about my feelings was really going to save my butt. And it did, because you know what? I spent my whole life working people, you know, lying and manipulating and using and abusing you in whatever way that I needed to get what I wanted out of you. And had this girl given me an inch, I would have done the same thing to her, and I wouldn't be standing here right now, probably. So I'm grateful that, you know, she was the way it was and didn't take any of my crap, and that God placed her into my life. So I started writing out my four step, and you know, I ran into some trouble here and there. I was having some difficulty seeing my part, my fault in things. And when we sat down and we did my first step, which, by the way, I was really nervous to do. I was, you know, not running to the table with my book to do my first step, because I was pretty sure that once this girl heard all this stuff, she was going to, like, run away crying, or she certainly wasn't going to be driving an hour to come and pick me up and drop me off every day. I was really scared of what she was going to think about me when she heard all of this stuff. And she didn't do any of that. You know, she helped me. She continued to tell me the truth that was difficult for me to see and difficult for me to hear, and that was going to save my butt. And we finished that fifth step, and I looked across the table from her, and I felt so connected to her, like I never felt with another human being in my life. You know, I she hugged me and she told me she loved me, and I totally believed it. It was a really beautiful feeling. And then she sent me off to go and do my sixth and seventh, and to sit alone and to think about what we had done and look at my character defects and say this prayer. And it was funny, as soon as I got into this room and I closed the door, I sat down and I just started crying, like bawling my eyes out. But I wasn't like sad or anything. It was just like an overwhelming feeling of gratitude. I had, for the first time in my life, seen the type of person that I had really been for so many years and all the destruction that I had really caused over the years. But I also felt so much hope that I didn't have to be that way anymore. And that with God's help, I was going to really have an opportunity to live a new life. And I sat there and I cried. And I said the prayer, and I walked out of that room with a feeling of hope I had never experienced before in my life. And I set out to do my eighth and ninth step. My eighth step, you know, my list for my eighth step being much longer than I had thought it was going to be. And my delusional thinking had me at a place where I was a little nervous to make some of my amends, you know, to a couple of, like, old friends or ex-coworkers, because I was afraid that they didn't really know about my drinking. Yeah, well, obviously, by whatever I shared with you, that was not the case. I was not nearly as smooth as I thought I was, and there was nobody that didn't know about my drinking. So I went out to make these amends, and, you know, I had mostly, you know, pretty positive responses. A lot of people were happy that I was doing what I was doing. They were grateful that I was doing what I was doing. And, you know, for the most part, they wished me the best, for the most part. A couple of amends stories that I would like to tell. One was my amends to my father. My dad died when I was 18. So, you know, of course I went to my sponsor and I'm like, how the heck am I supposed to make amends to somebody that's dead? And she said, what we'll do is choose, you know, some sort of meaningful place or something of, like, importance that, like, him and I shared, or, you know, something that would be significant. So anyway, what I decided to do was to go to his gravesite. And what was meaningful about that was that I had not been to my father's grave since he had died. So in 7 years from the day that we buried him, I had never been to my father's gravesite. I had a lot of feelings involved with that. Over the years, I had felt a whole array of emotions over my father's death, including anger and guilt and whatever. So to go there and to sit at the gravesite and read this letter that I had written to him was a very powerful experience for me. And it was very awesome. Another amends story that I like to tell is my amends with my sister. So my sister and I have, like, well, we're sisters, we've got a long history. But growing up, my parents drank a lot, and my sister was 8 years younger than I was, so I fell into, like, a parental role for her. On a lot of occasions. So she looked up to me in a certain way growing up, and my drinking really, really affected her, probably more than anybody else. So I had written out the harms that I felt like I caused her, and I was going to make amends for her. And just, I mean, it was my experience that when you're going to make, like, a big emotional amends, you may not want to do it in a public place. Because I chose to take her to the Cheesecake Factory at lunchtime. Yeah. To sit down and make this amends. Yeah. So I'm making my amends, and I'm crying, and then it gets to the point where I get to turn it over and she gets to share her piece, and now she's yelling and I'm crying, and it goes on. Now we're both crying, and the poor waiter, like, is like, oh my god, he didn't know what to do. He comes to the table, leaves the table. The people sitting around us just, they all wanted to get their check and get the heck out of there. But that was also a really nice amends, because our relationship hasn't been the same since. It's been able to grow in such tremendous ways. And also what I learned with that amends was that, you know, being a blackout drinker, there's only so much that I remembered. And my perception of the things that I did remember were a little bit different than the way she remembered them. So during that part where she got to share her piece, it was long. It was long. And it was painful to hear the damage that I had caused her. But like I said, our relationship has grown so much. It's very nice. So I made a lot of amends, and as far as what I like about steps 10 and 11, they're kind of like the, just because I get sober doesn't mean I'm not still human, and just because I get sober doesn't mean life stops happening. I still, make mistakes, bad things still happen. Both of those things happen a lot less now that I'm sober. But they still do occur, and what the SCIP program has given me is a way to, when those things do come up, I have a way to deal with them in a sane, sound manner, without ever thinking about having to pick up a drink or anything like that. The 11 step, actually the first meeting that I talked about that I walked out of and said I'm never doing that again, it was an 11 step meeting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I thought in that meeting was that, like, I heard prayer and meditation, I kind of thought I was going to be like sitting on a yoga mat and in the church for the rest of my life. That hasn't been the case. Prayer and meditation in my life today comes pretty naturally. I wake up in the morning and I say my prayers, and my meditation time is kind of worked around my son. I have an 18 month old son, so he kind of runs the show as far as my schedule goes. So I work it around him, and I go to bed and I pray at night, and it's just something that comes easily. I pause constantly throughout my day, and I make my conscious contact with God and ask him what he would have me do in situations, which is nice because I've gotten to see that growth, I guess, because, when I first got sober, I used to set an alarm in my phone to pray in the morning and at night, because it wasn't, like, something I was used to doing. I had to get used to practicing that kind of stuff, and now it's just something that comes very natural and is a pretty big part of my life, so I'm grateful for that. And finally, step 12, which to me is my favorite step, I don't know, but it's been an absolute honor in this program that I get the opportunity to go out and sponsor other women. Just the fact that I've gotten to a place where I can put my hand out and offer help to another human being is pretty remarkable. Because not only is that not something that I would have thought to do before I got sober, I was certainly not out there looking to help anybody but myself. but there's definitely nobody looking for my help either. So it's nice today to be able to take this message and pass it on. And, my experience with sponsoring girls has been that, when I first got sober, it was difficult, or it just didn't really happen. I wasn't necessarily able to see the changes that were happening in my life and to myself. For me, it was kind of like I just woke up one day and realized somehow I was okay. I was no longer thinking about drinking, and I was no longer suicidal. And I was happy with that. but I wasn't necessarily seeing all the little things that happened that got me to that point. And that's what I get to see with sponsoring other girls. And, you know, it's so nice to watch girls grow and, you know, see when that, like, light comes on in their eyes and the enthusiasm kicks in. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that. And, you know, when I do it, because I was told very early on that it's our duty in Alcoholics Anonymous to pass on this message. And that's what I try to do all the time. And, you know, it's been my experience that no matter what comes my way in sobriety, that if I do what I was taught in this program, I'm going to be okay. You know, you hear, like, a lot of people, at least I've heard a lot of people say, like, nobody either changes your first year of sobriety or talk about people, places, and things. And it's been my experience. I mean, my first year of sobriety, I moved twice. I got pregnant. I got married. I had a baby. My grandfather died. So there was a lot going on my first year. But what I've learned from that experience is that, like I said, if I remain willing and I do what I've been taught in this program and I remain teachable, and I stay close to my higher power and always am willing to get out there and put my hand out and be of service to my brother and sister, I'm going to be okay. You know, there's nothing that life is going to throw at me that has to take me out. So, you know, I used to hear when I first got sober that I was going to have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I thought it was just like, you know, something they said to make sure, like, they came back. But, I mean, it's true. I absolutely have a life beyond my wildest dreams. If anybody was going to tell me that, you know, I have a baby and love being a mother, I would have told them that they're crazy. That certainly, when I first got sober, did not sound like a life beyond my wildest dreams. That was not something that was anywhere, you know, in my thinking. I used to say even before I got sober that I was way too selfish to ever be a mother. But that's what I brought in. I have a beautiful son. I have meaningful relationships with people. I have a wonderful family. And I absolutely have life today beyond my wildest dreams. And I owe it to this program. I'm very, very grateful. So thank you for having me.